Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Moses heard voices, or one voice, the Bible tells us, the voice of God. So did Muhammad and Abraham and Joan of Arc. The Iliad tells us the Greek god spoke constantly to the heroes of the Trojan Wars. William Blake and John Milton said they heard voices. So did Socrates and many others across the centuries. Today, when people hear voices, we say they're ill. But human history is full of humans hearing voices in their heads and following. Up next on Point, muses, madmen, and prophets, the history and science of hearing voices. Joining me now from New York City is writer Daniel B. Smith, a former editor at the Atlantic Monthly. He writes about the brain and psychiatry. His new book is Muses, Madmen, and Prophets, Rethinking the History, Science, and Meaning of Auditory Hallucination. Daniel Smith, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's personal for you.
It is, yes. The reason I began to get interested in this subject was that when I was around 16, I was informed by my parents that my father had heard voices for most of his life, from the time he was around 13, in fact. They told me, they brought me to, I remember vividly, to a deli on Long Island where I was living with my parents, and they were worried that I, too, might hear voices. It turns out that that was not the case. I was just a teenager and was partying perhaps a little too much. And so what they saw as withdrawal, they thought, they worried because they knew that my father had heard voices for so many years. In fact, by the time he died, which was around 9 years ago, he had heard voices for 40 years.
And it turns out your grandfather had heard voices as well. And, of course, as you lay out for us here, human history is just brimming with people who heard voices, some of them among the most influential figures in our history.
Yeah, it's hard to even think of religion as we know it, monotheism as we know it, without thinking about voice hearing. Open up the Old Testament, and from the very first line, there is the voice of God. This is true in as well in Christianity and in Islam, of course. Was founded because Muhammad heard the voice of the Archangel Gabriel atop Mount Hira in 610 AD. So voice hearing really is almost the foundational experience of monotheism.
We're going to look at a lot of that history, and it is amazing, and also the science behind what we now call auditory hallucination. But before we do that, I want to get a sense, and it's a wonderful book. I mean, there's so many amazing stories about humans struggling with actually hearing voices in their head or from around the corner. But I want to have you, if you would, convey a sense of why you're looking at this. You've come to this with a purpose. You're trying to tell us something about hearing voices, auditory hallucination. Give us your thesis up front so we can hear it behind the history you share with us, Daniel.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think I should probably give a little bit more background about my father. He had, like I said, he had begun to hear voices when he was around 13. Uh-huh. But the only reason I know this is because I was able to unearth his psychiatric records. When he was around 40, he became very depressed and hospitalized himself. The problem that he had was not so much that he heard voices so much that I can tell, but that he was afraid to tell anyone that he heard voices. He was quite functional. He was not a madman. He was not schizophrenic or diagnosed with schizophrenia. He was an attorney and a father and a husband who just happened to hear voices. But he refused to tell anyone for very many years, for about 25 years, in fact, didn't tell his wife, didn't tell his family, didn't tell his friends.
Those voices burdened him, though, heavily, as you describe it.
Extremely heavily. This, again, is the reason I've written the book is because I know so little about his voices, but all I do know really is that they burden him so horribly. He heard them every day, and the fact that he heard them, he was so frightened about what they might mean about his mind, about his sanity. And in fact, his voices were quite mundane. They were almost the way that psychiatry explains people who suffer from obsessive compulsive disorder, mm-hmm. rather. telling him to move a pencil from one side of the table to the other. These were not voices that told him to hurt anybody, but he realized that if he told anyone about them, he might not get the things in life that he wanted, a family, a career, because people would assume that he was severely mentally ill. Once I learned about this, I became fascinated by it and couldn't write the story of hearing voices until my father died around 9 years ago. Mm-hmm. Couldn't even start thinking about it seriously because to his dying day, he refused to speak about them out of shame, except for that duty of telling his family about it so that if they too had problems, if myself or my brothers did, and none of us do hear voices, then we would know.
So pull away the stigma as one big goal here in writing about this history and this science.
Absolutely, yes. We tend to think reflexively of hearing voices as a psychiatric phenomenon, as something that bespeaks the most horrible psychiatric diagnosis one could be burdened with, and that's schizophrenia. Whereas, in fact, throughout history, hearing voices has not been thought of in that way.
Of course, there's a lot of things that our understanding has changed on throughout history, this not least. I want to get a lot of that history in our minds as we consider this, and we'll go on to the science and how it happens and what makes it happen, at least to the best we understand it today. But march us through, if you would, reach way back and march us through some of the sort of more prominent examples of you name Moses, you name Muhammad, but there are many more. Take us through some of the history of voice-hearing figures in the human record.
I'd be happy to. I'm glad you mentioned Moses, who happens to be my favorite voice here, largely because, like many people who heard voices throughout history, he didn't want to. Moses comes across, at least from my reading of the Old Testament, is extremely crotchety and complaining, and doesn't. He hears the voice of God, and he keeps saying, "Well, I'd prefer not to. I can't carry this burden." And I think a lot of people throughout history have experienced that. Certainly, many of the figures in the Old Testament have.
And Muhammad, a similar history comes down to us that it was painful for him to take this gift, as Islam has it.
Oh. Gut-wrenching. He worried that he had become a madman, or that he had become like one of the inspired poets of his time, who he did not think very highly of. And he ran to his wife in what seems, if it doesn't seem blasphemous to say so, like a panic attack, an absolute panic that he was going insane. And of course, what came out of it was all of Islam. There is an example of historical voice hearing that does not cause panic or trouble for people, and that is in the Iliad and in Hesiod's poetry. These are much more normal seeming to the people who hear them. There's a theory afoot, a very popular theory by a man named Julian Jaynes, who wrote a book that is still in print called The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind.
Mm. Controversial theory, but a really interesting one.
Absolutely controversial and unverifiable to the extreme, but extremely interesting. And the man was quite a polymath, Julian Jaynes, and the book holds up and has many fans.
What's the theory?
The theory is that prior to around 2000 BC, everybody heard voices, that there was a physical split between the left and right hemisphere of the brain that was the precursor to the consciousness that we experience today, that because they didn't have a unifying consciousness, a sense of I, they needed something to guide them, and that what guided them was this voice of the gods or the voice of the king telling them what to do.
So he's saying there was actually a biological reason that Achilles would stand there wanting to kill Agamemnon when he's taken his bride away. But he hears Athena, the goddess, he believes. This theory is that there was a physical reason for that.
Precisely. He thinks that he reads the Iliad completely literally. He reads the gods of the Greek pantheon literally. People who claimed to hear the voice of the great gods were actually hearing them. It was not a literary device. It was something that actually happened, and that changed for the reason of various cultural phenomena into the consciousness that we have today, this unified sense of self.
When you say hearing voices, you don't just mean that. I mean, what Christian liturgy is full of talk of the still small voice within, it often means conscience. It often means just awareness, I guess. But you mean actually hearing, viscerally hearing voices in one's mind.
Well, I don't only mean that. One of the great difficulties in working through this subject was that when I began, I thought I'd be meaning only the viscerally heard, the physical, sensory voice. But in fact, when you start to speak with people who hear voices, very often they are thinking metaphorically and speaking metaphorically. Our language doesn't quite allow for the nuances of these experiences, of having a thought or a feeling that comes to one as if it's not a part of our own consciousness, as if it's not a part of our own will. So a lot of times when people have these experiences, they simply say, it's a voice that came to me. So trying to parse the real from the metaphorical is not only difficult, but it seems to me perhaps even impossible. People, you can't question, of course, a lot of the figures in history, so it's difficult to know whether they actually heard a voice physically or whether they were simply using that as a metaphor for an experience that came to them with a great strength and a great force and a great meaning. I think meaning is the most important thing here.
You say over time, though, the way we take on hearing voices has really changed, become medicalized, even turned into a sort of a conversation about almost strictly about pathology.
It seems to me. It's important to note that not everyone plays by those rules, of course. I mean, it was widely circulated in 2003 that George W. Bush had told Mahmoud Abbas, Palestinian leader, according to Haaretz, that God had told him to strike at al-Qaeda and that God had told him to strike at Saddam, and now he was determined to solve the problem in the Middle East. So we have someone in the White House who has claimed, if not to have an auditory hallucination, but to hold conversations with the deity. So it's obvious that not everyone is playing by that those rational rules, but it is true that the man on the street, if you bring up the phenomenon of hearing voices, their mind will immediately go to the phenomenon of schizophrenia and to severe mental illness and to psychosis. That's not to diminish the extreme pain that people can have as a result of these disorders and these experiences, but it is somewhat impoverishing, in my view. It means that it cuts us off from a lot of other meanings that we can have, and it also has an effect on people, I think. These cultural meanings have a very profound effect on the way people experience, not just the way they think about them, but the way they experience these phenomena, these unusual sensory and phenomena of the mind.
What do we know about how common it is for humans to hear voices and begin to take us into the science of how it happens?
Yes, absolutely. What we know is not a great deal. We do know that when they do epidemiological surveys, around 3 to 5% of people have said that at one time or another they've heard a voice clearly and audibly. But then again, other people have done surveys that reach much higher than 3 to 5%. So it's difficult to know exactly. There's a study that I rather like by two American psychologists in the early 1980s. And they interviewed 375 college students and asked them a series of questions and asked them to either affirm or deny these statements. And so 59% answered yes to the statement that sometimes I've heard people say my name aloud. 39% said yes to the statement, I hear my thoughts aloud. And it's important to know that I hear my thoughts aloud is considered by psychiatry to be a so-called first-rank symptom of schizophrenia. 5% said that they heard a conversation, they affirmed that they've had an experience similar to that they've had a conversation with their dead grandmother as they got ready in the morning. So it's hard to say, but I would guess that it's a lot more common than people recognize or realize or perhaps want to think.
We've got a record going way back of what it feels like. I want to look at the science, but just to quote, you've got Teresa of Avila, a Spanish nun, 16th century, and she describes it very, very poignantly. She says, this is a woman who heard voices. She said, the words are perfectly formed, but they are not heard with the physical ear, yet they're received much more clearly than if they were so heard. And however hard one resists, it is impossible to shut them out. If we look at this in scientific terms, what's going on when that happens?
Well, the brain science of it is actually not very advanced. They've done quite a few studies to try to determine what goes on in the brain when a person experiences auditory hallucinations or these type of voices. And there is a burgeoning field in looking at mystical experience and brain science. But as far as auditory hallucinations, they simply do not know. I think people have a much greater faith in brain science than is perhaps justified if one actually looks at the evidence. It's not to say that we're not learning a great deal about the brain and that we're not benefiting from that. But for an experience as simple as one would think, as hearing a voice, really encompasses innumerable brain areas. And it's almost impossible to say that one thing causes it. So unfortunately, the answer that I have to give is that no one really knows what the reason is. There's another factor in this, science often looks not at so-called symptoms of mental illness, but at the mental illness itself, at the syndrome. So they'll look at people who have been diagnosed with schizophrenia, but not always specifically at this single experience. Psychiatry has really gotten into the state where they study larger disease entities, as they're called, and not individual experiences, which I think is in many cases a mistake.
Not just schizophrenia, you're saying, if you want to look at it through the medical books, hearing voices can be a symptom of brain tumor, Parkinson's disease, migraine headaches, temporal lobe epilepsy, Alzheimer's, various types of delirium. So there is a medical map of what may increase the odds of someone hearing voices.
Absolutely. There are many different diseases and conditions that can cause someone to hear voices, many more than simply psychotic illness, not only these physical illnesses, but also perhaps psychological trauma. There's a lot of study going on right now in England to look at trauma as a possible cause or trigger of psychotic experiences and of schizophrenia specifically. It's very controversial, as you could imagine, but there have been a lot of anecdotal evidence suggests that trauma can be a cause of hearing voices. One of the stories that I cite in the book and that I found fascinating was of a man named James Cameron, who's recently deceased, I believe, the civil rights activist. And he was one of only three men to survive a 1930 lynch mob. Mm. And he heard a voice right as he was about to be hanged saying that he had nothing to do with the crime. Seems to me to have very much to do with this extreme trauma he was going through.
Are you describing it then as if science is beginning to probe in here and understand this, still incomplete, are you saying that science is in effect debunking or making simply a symptom of pathology, these great religious figures and others in history who heard voices? Or are you saying science has diminished an experience that is human and greater than that kind of laboratory understanding of it?
There's nothing diminishing, I don't think, about studying the biological or neurological correlates of these experiences. I think some people would think that there's something diminishing about looking about mystical experience or religious voice hearing in terms of the brain. To me, that's simply looking a little deeper and following scientific curiosity. There is something diminishing about talking about auditory hallucinations exclusively in terms of pathology. Looking at the neurological substrate of these experiences doesn't necessarily mean that we're looking at their pathological substrate. It simply means we're looking at what areas of the brain might be involved. But science does look more or less exclusively at people who hear voices who have been diagnosed with severe mental illness, and not just people who have heard voices. It tends to look, for obvious reasons, because it wants to help these people and wants to understand these disorders more than they do right now, which is not very well. But there is something diminishing about that for people. It means that for the culture at large, hearing a voice is going to be thought of in these pathological terms, and someone who hears a voice might not be willing to confess this to people, to their loved ones, to anyone else, or to think of it in terms of something that could have meaning for their lives or something that might carry a message, as some people say, of this experience.
And yet, interesting that we may look at it as pathology today when it happens in a contemporary setting. We look back hundreds or thousands of years and describe it as sacred. Daniel Smith's book is Muses, Madmen, and Prophets. We're talking about humans hearing voices. Let me go to Alex in Boston. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I wanted to also reference, there's another great book out there called The Midnight Disease by Alice Flaherty. She was She is a neurologist at Massachusetts General Hospital,
yeah.
And she writes about the creative mind and writing in terms of mental disorder as well. She starts out with writer's block and then the compulsion to write, but she also has a whole section dedicated towards the experience of muses, and she focuses on sort of like the dissociative experience that comes when you're writing or when you feel like you're being directed by another entity, kind of what to say, what to write, moving your hand across the page.
But when we think of muses, we think of inspiration. Does it go as far as, or do you see it as going as far as auditory hallucination, Alex?
Yes, well, she described how, like, many writers do describe, like, feeling like they're no longer in control, that there's this dissociative experience, that they're not hearing their own voice anymore, that they're not controlling their own hand anymore, and she tries to go through some of the neurological science behind it. But as well, I mean, there's limitations in that, and what's kind of always intrigued me was that oftentimes these great ideas, I mean, founders of religions and everything, that will attribute hearing outside sources, and it makes you wonder whether it's because humans or these individuals just don't feel courageous enough to sort of take that voice onto their own, to sort of to understand it under a psychological sort of complex of that it's them still speaking, but they're not really confident enough, I guess. You can't really say, oh, I'm getting this
it's me.
From my own mind. It sounds better if you're saying I'm getting it from an outside source.
So hand it to a deity, yeah. Perhaps. Daniel Smith, how do you look at that? I mean, some of the ideas that have come in this way are so grand and sweeping that it may be hard to picture them as coming from other than a deity. But Alex says, well, turn around and look at oneself when you hear voices.
Yeah, well, I think that's what most poets who have that experience, most scientists who have that experience of seeming as if an idea came to them out of the blue, do look to themselves these days. It's something that I talk about in the book, that at one point that wasn't the case, that auditory hallucination really did go hand in hand with this literary inspiration. The poet Hesiod had an experience, according to his poetry, around the same time as the Homeric poems were coming into existence, that was very similar to Muhammad's. He was on a mountain. He was a shepherd, very similar also to the prophet Amos. And he heard a voice while he was on the mountain shepherding his flock, and claimed that this voice, he took dictation from this voice for his poetry. At some point, I think it became more internal. People started to think of these inspirational experiences in terms of their own mind and their own psychology. So that you come across very few people who are willing to say, well, this comes from an outside source. You do come across a few. James Merrill, of course, the poet, said that they came from ghosts and from spirits that he would summon from the Ouija board, but he didn't call them auditory hallucinations. But people are usually thought of as a bit kooky if they go as far as to say it's an outside deity or an external experience.
Let's go to David in Wellesley, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Smith. I'm a classical music critic, and I'm just now writing an article about the last composition by the composer Robert Schumann.
Mm.
And he suffered terribly late in his life from auditory hallucinations. And I do mean suffered, because many of them were quite demonic and terrifying. But in the case of this composition, he believed that an angel had come to him and dictated the theme for this theme and variations. And so that's one very strong example of...
David, let me ask you, in Schumann's case, were his auditory hallucinations always musical, or were they voices as well? Did he feel spoken to?
There were times when he felt like someone was telling him to do something. In fact, while he was writing this piece, he felt someone was telling him to kill himself, and he went and threw himself in the Rhine River.
Wow.
And had to be fished out by some fishermen. And after that, he went into an asylum, and he ended his days there.
So both...
It's a very tragic story.
Yeah, both music coming to him down a channel, something like that, and a kind of demonic voice that tell him to kill himself. Daniel Smith, what do you know about the Schumann story? Does it ring true with others you've researched?
It does. I didn't look into the Schumann story and didn't look very deeply into what are known in the clinical literature as musical hallucinations, but I did interview one gentleman, a journalist, who had suffered from a fall down the stairs in childhood and had a lesion on his brain. And he heard full songs in his head, full orchestral arrangements in his head for many years, though. And he didn't know what was wrong with him. And he went, and people diagnosed him as schizophrenic, and they gave him antipsychotic medication until they did a brain scan and saw this lesion, which I believe they now control with anti-epileptic medication. But there are, from what I know and from what I've read in the literature, many examples of people, of composers who have heard songs and music in their head. To me, it's not terribly surprising, when I think that hearing voices is very related to these thoughts that get stuck into our heads.
And the demonic voice, not at all rare. We've talked about people thinking they heard the voice of God, but many tortured by voices, pushing them towards self-destruction.
Yes, I think that's true. Often people who suffer very seriously from very serious mental illness believe that they're hearing the voice of the devil. And these examples crop up a lot in classic psychiatric texts. But of course, you come across it very much, and it's been a problem for the church, of course, in trying to determine what to do when someone is hearing supposedly the voice of the devil. It's by no means just a glowing religious phenomenon. There's a dark side to it as well. And of course, in the Middle Ages, this was the problem that the ecclesiastical authorities had to deal with. Someone like Joan of Arc, was she truly hearing the voice of angels or the voice of God, or was she hearing the voice of the devil or the voice of demons? This was a very serious question during the Inquisition and during the Middle Ages, and had, of course, some very famous and very terrible results.
Let's take a call from Pocatello, Idaho. Janae, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know, Janae?
Well, I had an experience once. You want me to just tell you about it?
Yes, please.
Okay. I was about 16. I'm 38 now.
Okay.
And when I came home from high school that day, and I thought I was alone in the house, and I was practicing the piano,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, in my head, I heard this voice that asked me if I knew where my younger siblings were.
What did it sound like? Was this just a kind of a worry cropping up? I wonder where my younger siblings are, or something else?
No, it was such a strange thing. It was like when you're thinking to yourself and you hear your voice in your head just as you go throughout your day.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like that, except for it was a thought that was interjected totally from somewhere else. And the interesting thing about it was that I kind of answered the question, and I said, well, they're probably outside playing. Mm. And I continued to practice, and then I heard this thought again, or this voice again, clearly say, what would you do if one of them got hurt? And I was kind of surprised at that thought, but I again answered in my mind, and I said, well, I would take them to the hospital. And then the voice said, what would you do if one of them got shot? And at that point, I was really, really kind of shocked. It was a strange experience. And then about 30 seconds later, I heard a gunshot from the garage. And I ran over to the stairs, which led to the garage, and heard my younger brother, who was about 10 years old at the time, come down the stairs crying. And we met at the bottom of the stairs, and he had his hands clutched over his chest and had blood streaming through his fingers. And I knew at that point that he was okay, because he was still breathing fine and was able to speak.
Thank heavens.
And as coincidence would have it, a few days earlier in my AP biology class, we had learned about your respiratory system and about your pleural lining, and how if it is punctured, you're not able to talk or to breathe very well. And so the whole experience I interpret as a guardian angel.
But he had been shot.
Yes, he had. He had a few days earlier, he had seen a neighbor, an adult neighbor, with a bullet necklace. The neighbor had drilled through it and made a necklace out of it.
Yeah.
And my brother wanted one, too, and so he took a .22 shell and put it in the vise in my dad's garage.
And popped it
down so tight that it exploded, and some shrapnel actually went into his chest, but was stopped by his sternum.
Janae, hold it right there. Daniel Smith, what do you hear in this story?
It's very difficult for me to try to understand or interpret stories like this. I think scientists who have looked at these voices that seem to predict certain experiences, certain events, they've had a lot of trouble with it. And the person who, of course, jumps to mind is William James, who got many complaints from his fellow scientists, fellow psychologists, fellow physicians, who looked very carefully at these experiences because they seem to come from somewhere. I don't quite know what to make of it, except that perhaps something would have prompted her to have this worry. But then again, I'm very reluctant to challenge anyone's interpretation of these things if that's the interpretation that they find is the most useful or they find is the most meaningful. To me, that pragmatic stance is the most humane, so that while I don't believe that a guardian angel can come down and speak to us, I don't want to take away anyone's right to say that.
Janae, that's the interpretation you've put on it. Guardian angel, has it ever come back? Or was this a one-time-only event for you?
That was a one-time-only event.
Wow. What a story. I really appreciate your sharing it. And your brother turned out all right, we hope.
Yes, he was. He was
good.
Perfectly fine.
Thank you very...
It had only, like I said, it had been stopped by the sternum, and it was one piece of shrapnel, which he still keeps to this day.
But you felt that you'd been told in the moments before, and there's just the kind of story that we hear repeated down through time. Janae, thanks for that. Let me go to Baltimore and Chris. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just got one question for your guests, and it seemed pretty obvious to me right when I heard you start the discussion. I was wondering if there's any accounts of more than one or even a group of people hearing a single voice and a single message in one single experience. And I can think of some example in the Bible where Jesus was baptized and there was a voice from heaven saying, "This is my only son." But are there any other accounts such as that, and what might the explanation for that be, if there are?
A kind of mass hearing of voices at once. Daniel Smith?
That's a very interesting question, a great question. I haven't come across any, to be honest. It's very rarely spoken about in the literature. One comes to mind, and I hope I'm getting this correct, and that is medieval Jewish rabbis gathering around the grave of one of their prophets and having a very similar auditory experience. Prayer, perhaps mass prayer, is the type of thing that might cause a group experience. But at least from what I've looked at throughout history, it's not exclusively, but most commonly been an individual experience. So I wish I could shed some light on that, but I haven't come across, I'm afraid, very many, except for the one that you mentioned, the biblical examples.
It's a great question, though. Let's take another call from Greg in Melrose, Massachusetts. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Well, thank you. What do you know?
Well, I've studied meditation for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And my background is mostly psychology and Jung and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And to my way of thinking, if you look back and then apply really hard work at meditation over many years, for instance, I had an American Indian teacher who said, don't get caught up in thoughts, voices that you hear in your head that might just be part of sort of a cultural flow that everybody is hearing at the same time, which you were just mentioning.
Kind of stream of conscience babble.
Yeah, it's almost like we sort of tap into the collective unconscious, mm-hmm. and everyone tends to sort of be on the same track. He was always about try to quiet down the mind enough to hear the really quiet voice inside. And when hearing that, reach the point where you sort of have this experience of gnosis, where through direct experience, there's just knowledge. There's no way you can explain through language to another person.
But Greg, let me ask you, when you aim for that, when you try to get past the sort of babble and toward that quiet voice, is that something that you interpret as hearing voices, or is that simply a kind of quieted mind hearing its own innermost musing?
I think the only way I could put that is I no longer believe in separation. I feel as though we're all connected, and the more science breaks things down into individual parts, separates things out, and looks for a connection between things in sort of analytical, right-brained way, the more lost it will get on this sort of subject. I mean, I'm Scottish. I was born with a call, so to, you know, grow up answering my family, you know, answering each other's, finishing out each other's conversations or sentences was common for me, or to dream what would happen the next day and then see it in Technicolor exactly as I had dreamt it was just the natural thing as a child.
But you're looking to sort of let it flow together, not try and separate it out and dissect it on its own now. We appreciate that call. I want to get another, if I may. We've got so many trying to get in here, and I hope you'll forgive me, Greg. Let me go to East Lansing, Michigan. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks very much. I just wanted to mention that I had a professor at Michigan State many years ago who taught the theory that Julian James has written about in the Bicameral Mind book. And I always thought that the big danger of kind of trying to discover the mysteries of neurology through reading the classics, mm-hmm. was that you end up trying to go backwards from stories to science. And
yes.
It sounds like Mr. Smith is very wary of that same thing. And I just wondered if he specifically did refute James' theory, because, you know, 10,000 years ago is a very short period of time to go through the radical neurology changes that James talks about. And in my paper for this humanities class, I refuted the theory. And I just wondered where Mr. Smith sat on that.
Daniel Smith?
I think James's theory is extremely clever. I think it's unverifiable and it's irrefutable. I don't have a problem with extrapolating from stories to science. In fact, I think that we should do a little bit more of that. Psychology and psychiatry nowadays is very quantitative, and I would love to see them concentrate a little bit more on the qualitative and on people's stories. It's not to say that a lot don't do that. As far as James's theory is concerned, I don't think anyone.
This again,
can
the
say,
theory that the brain was actually different as recently as a couple
yes.
thousand years ago.
Around, I believe, 3,000 or 4,000 years
mm-hmm.
ago, the brain was different. I think it's extremely clever. Like I've said, I don't think anyone can say one way or another whether it's true. I don't know how one could, unless a brain had somehow been fossilized, and I'm not an archaeologist. Don't even know if that's possible, but. It's something that a lot of people have tried to refute. It's something that a lot of people have tried to verify. And to me, it's just a beautiful, interesting, very well thought out theory. But I remain perhaps cowardly neutral on the matter.
Tom, of course, was drawn to refute it. You say you have no problem looking to draw science from stories. Is it science in that case, or is it more? Is it a kind of poetic understanding of hearing voices that you're yearning for, pushing for?
Well, it might not be what we think of as hard science, but I have trouble thinking of the helping profession, psychiatry and clinical psychology, in terms of hard science, just because I know a little bit about the brain and I'm skeptical as to the possibility that our knowledge is going to increase to the point where we can really think of these experiences exclusively in terms of neurology or biology or any of the scientific realms of thought that might make us feel as if we have a real good grasp on it. Mm. I think it always comes down to people's experiences, and it always comes down to what they say. There's only one way to really get at what someone's experiencing, and that's by speaking with them. Language is the only thing we have, and that's why it's so important in an experience like voice hearing or any of these unusual and often difficult experiences.
I want to get one more call, if I may. Deborah from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Daniel Smith. Deborah.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
I wanted to say that I've definitely heard, in a very auditory sense, several times in my life, voices that I felt like were very friendly, directive things that were telling me the next thing to do, and not at all been afraid of them.
Didn't make you feel crazy? Didn't make you feel, you know, out of control?
No.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was actually the most clear. It was very calming in a way because it felt very clear and very real.
Did you know? Did you believe it was something inside your head? Did it sound from around the corner or the back seat?
No, it was as if there was someone standing beside me, and I heard the voice as clear as you were standing beside me telling me something, and it felt very benevolent. And I knew that I wasn't crazy, and I knew there wasn't a person beside me.
Did you tell anyone?
Mm-hmm. And I've gone to a spiritual school for a little over 5 years now, where the kind of major point is to, like, I think it was two callers ago who was talking about a Native American teacher he
mm-hmm,
had,
mm-hmm.
to go inside past all the, you know, kind of commonly held ideas and chatter and worry and noise to hear a voice that I'm taught to know isn't just sort of something that's from my own thinking mind, but something that's from the divine voice that wants to, knows the best for me, and I can ask very specific questions and find out very specific practical answers to things. And I find it a very, very peaceful way to kind of go about my life and make my decisions.
Wow, there's another personal experience and an embrace of it in your case, Deborah. Thanks for that. Daniel Smith, our time is so short. Your grandfather heard voices, your father heard voices. As I read your book, you never have. Are you yearning to hear voices or just satisfied to write about it?
No, I'm just satisfied to write about it. I'm not terrified or frightened in any way of hearing voices. I don't think I'd want to be burdened by hearing them on a regular basis. But I never have, and although I made some attempts to do so, which I describe in the book, there was no way I could. I'm very aware that my own children, for whatever genetic reason, could hear voices. And to be quite honest, I would probably hope that they wouldn't. It's something that in this day and age is a very difficult thing to carry along.
Well, it's been a great and fascinating tour of that realm. We're grateful to you for bringing it to us and the new book, Muses, Madmen, and Prophets. Daniel Smith, thanks very much for joining us this hour.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And listeners, you can read an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.